Major funding for soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Aristotle and the Good Life, this week on Soundings. My guest is Marcia Homiak, a professor of philosophy at Occidental College. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Marcia Homiak is at work on a study of Aristotelian ethics. Marcia Homiak, welcome to Soundings, a wonderful philosophical topic. What does it mean to lead a good life? Questions about human character. Take me back to the days of Aristotle.
Well, for Aristotle, a good life was the best life that a human being could live, the best life that a human being was capable of. And for him, this meant, in particular, that one lived what he would call a morally virtuous life, and also what he would think of as an active political life. So I think the two main ingredients for him in a good life are that one is morally virtuous, and also that one's an active citizen of one's community.
This is a wonderful combination of the public and the private.
Right.
But we don't often associate a good moral life with a good public life these days.
Yeah, that's right.
How did Aristotle make that equation? Be specific for me. What were some of the components here?
Well, this is a very hard question. Aristotle is fond of saying things such as the following. Ethics is a part of politics. And it's hard to know exactly what he meant by this, but part of it, I think, is this. He thinks that this good life, this best life that's possible for a human being, is one that involves the full and unimpeded actualization of the powers and abilities that are characteristic of human beings.
You're going to take me into the language of the human potential movement. It's as old as Aristotle.
Well, yeah, you know, that's a way in which Aristotle's ethics can be made very much accessible to a modern audience, both to reflective and to unreflective modern audiences, since this idea of self-realization and self-actualization, I take it, is quite trendy. But in any case, he thought, of course, that the powers characteristic of human beings, the most important powers characteristic of human beings, were ones that involved our rational faculty, our ability to reason.
Did Aristotle think, for example, Marcia Homiak, that human beings were essentially good?
No, certainly not. And this is a very important question, actually, very important, because that's why this good life that we've been talking about is a political life. Another way in which you can think about that is that he thought that the best life possible for human beings was one that had to be lived in a particular kind of environment.
So, meaning what?
Well, it was only, again, if you lived in a community that enabled you to express your decision-making powers in the fullest way, a community in which you actually had control over the decisions that really mattered. It was only under those circumstances that you could fully express your human powers and hence live a pleasant and ultimately morally virtuous life.
Are we talking about a democracy? Or are we talking about a monarchy?
We're talking,
be specific,
you know,
for me.
If you remember antiquity. I mean, Aristotle was not what we would call a democrat in that, of course, he had views that were characteristic of his time. He thought that it was all right to own slaves, and he thought that women, of course, couldn't possibly live the best life available to human beings, since in some sense, for him, women weren't full human beings. They didn't have fully operative rational faculties, and of course, neither did slaves. So these people, and even, you know, He also had bad views about manual laborers. None of these groups of people could live this full human life. But for persons who had fully operative rational faculties, that is to say, you know, for male citizens of the polis, male citizens of the city-state, it was certainly possible for them.
Well, apart then from his prejudices, which we shall not try to account for,
that's right,
Marcia Homiak, help me to understand what rationality amounted to for Aristotle, and in consequence of this, the good life. You take me.
Yes.
I've been thinking about the lyrics to that wonderful old Tony Bennett song, the the good life. Not to trivialize, but I suppose there is something in common there.
Well, I don't remember the wonderful old Tony Bennett song, but again, the question you asked me is an extraordinarily difficult one. I'm not going to shirk it. I will answer it. But you must realize that it's a question about which there is a great deal of controversy, and everybody who interprets Aristotle's ethics has a different answer to your question.
Fair enough. Let me have yours.
Here's mine. The best life for a human being is one in which we fully exercise our rational faculty. What does that mean? For me, it means that we fully exercise the rational faculties that we use when we engage in ordinary pedestrian life. What I mean by that is some people, for many years, for centuries, in fact, when people read Aristotle's Ethics and they came across these passages in Book One of the Ethics where Aristotle says, the best human life is a life in which we fully exercise our rational powers, what they thought was that Aristotle meant that we exercise our theoretical powers fully. If we exercise our theoretical powers fully, then we can engage in grand philosophical speculation about the nature of the universe, about the movements of the stars. We can become, in fact, as close to a divine being, as close to a god, as it's possible for a human being to be. And it's that life, the life that most easily enables us to approximate to divinity, that for years and years and years, people thought was the life Aristotle was recommending.
All right, now in contrast to that.
Right. In contrast to that, Aristotle has this notion of practical reasoning, which is different from theoretical reasoning. Hmm. And practical reasoning is the reasoning that you and I engage in every single day of our lives, in virtually every activity that we perform.
Should I run a red light? Should I tell the clerk that he's given me $2 more than he deserves?
Yeah, but it's not even should questions. It doesn't even have to be should questions. It might simply be, you know, what am I going to get at the grocery store today?
I mean, thinking about your life.
Yeah, just thinking about your life. Now, to put it in slightly more abstract terms for a minute, so it doesn't sound quite so ridiculous, the idea is that virtually at all moments of your life, when you're engaged in these activities that are characteristic of a human being, you're making decisions, you're making discriminations, you're judging, you're deciding, you're choosing. Mm-hmm.
Discrimination in Aristotle's vocabulary is not a dirty word.
Well, that's my word. That's not a word that he uses. Uh-huh. But I use all these words to try to suggest the quotidian element of the rational activity that I'm talking about.
The daily element.
Exactly. So, on my view, the idea is that you exercise these powers well. You exercise them in a full and unimpeded way. When you come to take more enjoyment from this activity that is characteristic of human beings than from any other activity that you could perform. For example, Aristotle is fond of saying that certain traits of character that he would find condemnable, that we, in our translation of the Greek, would refer to as moral vices. He thinks some of these moral vices are vices that human beings who haven't fully developed their human powers and who then, in a sense, seem closer to animals than human beings would enjoy doing. So, for example, one of the standard Greek moral vices is the vice of intemperance or self-indulgence.
Too much eating, too much of anything.
Well, not even simply too much, but the idea for Aristotle is the temperate person is a person who enjoys the bodily appetites, eating, drinking, and what he would call ta aphrodisia, the things of Aphrodite. The temperate person enjoys eating, drinking, and ta aphrodisia, but they enjoy it in the right way. And they enjoy it at the right times, they enjoy it to the right extent, they enjoy it towards the right people, and so on. And the self-indulgent person is somebody who, as he would say, overshoots the mean, that is, probably takes too much pleasure from the bodily appetites, or takes pleasure at the wrong moments, or towards the wrong persons, and so on.
How do you figure out how to become temperate?
Well, now,
am I getting ahead of the story here?
Yeah, you're getting ahead, and I will try to answer that to the best of my ability, which will be even harder than what I'm about to explain now, or what I'm trying to explain now. But the idea is, when Aristotle talks about the self-indulgent person, there's this wonderful passage in the Ethics where he says, the intemperate person, or the self-indulgent person, is like someone who prayed that his throat was longer than a crane's.
Oh, goodness, what an image.
Meaning that for Aristotle, the self-indulgent person is the person who enjoys most the physical sensation of touching and tasting. So they pray that their throat is longer than a crane so that they can enjoy the sensation for a longer period of time.
Something of a satirist as well as a philosopher.
Yeah. And he says the temperate person, on the other hand, is somebody who enjoys the discrimination. Actually, that is indeed a word that is there, often used in translation of what he's saying. Enjoys the discriminations involved in touching and tasting. So the idea is the temperate person enjoys the rational activity surrounding the experience of the bodily appetites, and the intemperate person, the self-indulgent person, doesn't take enough enjoyment from that rational activity. They like simply the touch and the taste.
You remind me, Marcia Homiak, of one of the great debates in American education today. I'm not sure if we're mixing cosmic apples and oranges here. But the idea of getting kids to think critically, reading and writing as ends in themselves, but also as means to the examination of one's life. That's what you're telling me, that Aristotle urges us to think about the way we think.
Well, I think that might be too modern.
Too complicated.
Too modern a way to put it. He doesn't think. You see, the danger with the view you're suggesting is that, and this is a perfectly reasonable thing to say of me, given what I've said to you. But the danger with the thing you're suggesting is that one gets the picture that the Aristotelian good life consists in this constant reflection about what you're doing, you know, so that you can't make a move without asking yourself, gee, what are all the various alternatives here, and which one should I choose, and so on. Yeah. That's not the idea. The idea is you have, and this goes back to a question you asked me before, okay? We were talking maybe 5 minutes ago about the relationship between ethics and politics, and I was trying to answer that by saying that one of the things that involves is that we grow up in the proper kind of community, that we are citizens of the proper kind of community. Well, part of the idea there is that the best kind of community for Aristotle is the one that will enable its citizens to learn to love the exercise of their characteristic human powers more than the exercise of these powers that we share with other beings who aren't human. So the point is that if you are educated properly, as a young person, you will come to love these things about yourself. That is, you will come to love what is most really you. And as a result, you will develop a confidence in who you are and what you can do.
Is there a way, Marcia Homiak, to measure the success of systems like this? I understand that you're not a historian. You are a philosopher and a historian of philosophy. Is there a way to figure out that this overarching educational goal or system that you're describing worked in antiquity, has applications today? Does that take us off the track, really?
Yes and no. The picture that Aristotle is offering is of an ideal. And since living the ideal requires living in the proper kind of community, it can't be fully realized unless material conditions are quite different.
Well, does that word ideal right there stop us in our tracks?
That it's
unachievable and utopian?
No, because Now, you can think of it in the following way. I talked a few seconds ago about the goals, so to speak, of moral education, or one of the goals of moral education for an Aristotelian, would be that one come to develop a confidence in who one is and what one can do. For Aristotle, a key thing about the best life is that it is a life that is one's own. And part of what this means is that it cannot be a life lived through others.
Uh-huh.
It has to be a life in which we enjoy the actualization of our own abilities and our own talents.
Was it Voltaire who said that the truly happy person or complete person is the one who can sit in a room by himself or herself with no distractions and be happy? Imagine putting kids today into that situation.
Well,
no TV sets, no playgrounds.
Well, now, you know, one doesn't actualize one's abilities without objects. I mean, it's not simply a matter of drumming it all up from the inside.
Isolation.
Right. It's not isolation, because once again, remember, ethics is a part of politics.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the idea of that is, you raise a very important point, which I had neglected to emphasize. Part of the point of this is that you can't develop what Aristotle calls this self-love. The closest equivalent, I think, we have would be something like self-esteem, or I've mm-hmm. been saying self-confidence.
Mm-hmm.
He calls it self-love. The idea is that the happiest person, who is also the morally virtuous person, is someone who has what he calls true self-love. One can't develop this without living in a community of other people who also have it, because it's not drummed up by oneself, through oneself. It's not sustained and maintained over time by oneself. That's, again, why living in the community is so important.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, in the first book of the Nicomachean Ethics, Aristotle talks about Priam, you know, the king of Troy, who during his life, of course, was thought to be an extraordinarily virtuous and admirable human being.
But
Troy is destroyed.
Yeah.
All his sons are killed. His grandson, Astyanax, Hector's son, is thrown from the parapets of Troy.
So aside from his individual virtue,
exactly.
the key to it, we measure it in communal terms.
Well, the key to his life, he can't live a happy life or a life that's best for human beings under those tragic circumstances. He might, for some time, be able to retain various virtuous traits of character that he has mm-hmm. developed over time. But, of course, the happiness of his life, the best qualities of his life, so to speak, are going eventually to evaporate.
Uh-huh.
That's part of, I think, what's quite sensible about Aristotle, and a way in which he's very different, say, from people who came after him, such as the Stoics, who mm-hmm. thought, you know, that really all that mattered was something internal, something that
pulling back from society,
something that we could sustain on our own.
Marcia Homiak, doesn't this leave us with the problem of some sort of communal conflict? If in some ideal world, and yet practical world, rational world, according to Aristotle's definitions, we arrive at this strong sense of ourselves, we are morally virtuous and happy internally and therefore capable in a communal sense, aren't we going to have a lot of strong-willed egos bumping up against one another? Didn't one of the philosophers say that my rights end when my fist touches the end of your nose, something like that?
Well, gee, I hope that Aristotle isn't led to those consequences, and I don't think he is, for the following reason. You raise yet another, you see, important question. The idea is this. When you're developing this self-love, as Aristotle understands it, you develop this confidence in who you are and what you can do. Part of what's going on in that process is that you recognize that what provides you with feelings of self-love, feelings of self-esteem, are precisely those qualities that you share with others.
Mm-hmm. That communal sense again.
Exactly.
You understand your own limitations.
Well, it's not so much a matter of understanding your limitations. It's a matter of understanding how, when Wayne Pond, for example, were he to actualize his talents and abilities, his potentialities in a full and unimpeded way, I, Marcia Homiak, good Aristotelian that I am, would take just as much enjoyment
in that
from the actualization of Wayne Pond's talents and abilities mm-hmm. as I take from my own. Why? Because Wayne Pond's talents and abilities are just as characteristically human mm-hmm. as mine. Mm-hmm. Aristotle says, you are, for me, another myself, you see. So what I feel about myself...
That's wonderfully mystical. That's
not
rational.
No. It's completely rational. We don't import any of these strange non-philosophical notions here. We keep them in another ballpark. No, it's perfectly rational, mm-hmm. okay? Because you're exhibiting your characteristic human powers. You're manifesting your characteristic human powers. And if I love the manifestation of my own... When I see them in someone else, they're as though they were me mm-hmm. if I had made other choices.
And yet you say that Aristotle does not believe in the fundamental good. I don't know if you want to get into questions about original sin and things like that.
Oh, yes, Well, you should understand that now from what I've said. Okay. Of course, we're not born good or bad.
We're socialized into it.
We have to learn to develop our powers. Mm-hmm. And depending on the community in which we live, we'll either be able to develop them properly in the full and unimpeded way, mm-hmm. or, you know, if we're not fortunate to grow up in a community that enables us to do that, we'll be educated badly, and we will, as a result, develop various of these traits of character that Aristotle condemns.
Marcia Homiak, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. This is wonderful. It's encouraging and very, very favorable, positive to sit and listen to you talk about Aristotle and Aristotelian ethics and the aims of education and the potential for human goodness. Don't we have a couple of thousand years of history that just offset all of this? That's a very large question. The smaller question is, where are you headed with your investigation of Aristotle? So what, in effect?
Well, as I hope you can see from the fervor that I am able to muster about these topics,
indeed,
I think I find studying Aristotle and working on Aristotle to be tremendously sustaining because it helps me with my own life. I become more and more convinced, you see, that Aristotle was on the right track about these kind of fundamental aspects of human life. Mm-hmm. And the more I think about it, the more I try to integrate these matters into my own life. And in fact, though I don't live in an ideal community, so I can't possibly achieve the ideal that Aristotle is describing.
Doesn't make them any less worthy.
No, it doesn't. And I find that I am able to improve my own life, and I think I am able to contribute to the improvement of my students' lives.
Well, I'm going to raise the question about your students. A lot of talk these days about how cynical they all are, and they want to be MBAs, and they don't care about philosophy and literature. And now you live in a bit of a bubble, Marcia Homiak. You teach at a small liberal arts college. Judging by that yardstick or by the experiences of your colleagues, how would you characterize our undergraduates today? Are they responsive to the philosophy of antiquity? What good is it to them?
Well, I very much believe that moral philosophy and political philosophy are relevant to how we live. And I very much believe it doesn't have to be the study of Aristotle, but it can be the study of any truly great thinker. I think studying these people can help us better our own lives. They can help us, if only to the extent of making us more reflective about mm-hmm. what we're doing. That's something you talked about at the very beginning. And I think it's pretty easy to show students that this is the case.
How do they respond when you talk about these wonderful, noble goals, these Aristotelian notions about rationality and leading the good life? Do they sit back and say, oh, ho-hum, or do they pick up the baton and run with it?
Well, some of them enjoy it a great deal. Some of them come to be convinced that they can't let their college years, they can't abuse their college years in some way, that this is an extremely important part of their life, a point in their life that they really have to take advantage of, because they may not ever have 4 years like this again.
Do you think it helps them to place themselves in a social context? We've been talking about Aristotle.
Yeah, I do.
Social contexts then. What about now?
I do think so. I think they grow and they learn by participating in all sorts of political controversies, of which, you know, there are really quite a number.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, students, I don't think, are apolitical or unconcerned about the future of their world.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're quite concerned about it. And one way that studying moral and political philosophy can help them is that it always becomes relevant to the political controversies that they're involved in at the moment.
Mm-hmm. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a conversation with Marcia Homiak, a professor of philosophy at Occidental College. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Marcia Homiak is at work on a study of Aristotelian ethics. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 447. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, a discussion about ideological rhetoric in the English novel in the 18th and 19th centuries. My guest will be Daniel Gunn of the University of Maine at Farmington. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. The last week in April marks birthdays for the English playwright and poet William Shakespeare, the Russian revolutionary Nikolai Lenin, the English novelist Mary Wollstonecraft Godwin, and the American landscape architect Frederick Law Olmsted, the designer of New York Central Park. Shakespeare was born in late April 1564, Lenin in 1870, Godwin in 1759, and Olmsted in 1822. Late April also marks an anniversary for the Library of Congress, established in 1800. Finally, the last week in April is the occasion of Martin Waldseemüller Remembrance Day. Martin Waldseemüller was the German geographer who gave the New World its name when he published a book in April 1507, mistakenly citing Amerigo Vespucci as the discoverer of the Western Hemisphere. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Aristotle and the Good Life, this week on Soundings. What does it mean to live a good life? How does one create the proper balance between private morality and public participation? Listen for Marcia Homiak of Occidental College. Marcia Homiak is at work on a study of Aristotelian ethics. Aristotle and the Good Life, this week on Soundings.